morning. Rocket talk to everybody. Good morning, everybody. Nice to see people here. Welcome. I'm sorry I wasn't here last week, but I'm sure it was a good share nevertheless. Pleased to be back. I'm very happy to say at the beginning of the share that the share is sponsored by Miriam Marcus, who is, as you know, a regular at the share. In loving memory of her mother, Liba Pesha Bat Natan, Alea Shalom. This is her first yahrzeit. Her yahrzeit is on Zayin Menachem Av, which is tonight. And I remember it's been a quick year since the Shiva there on Tisha B'Av that I came to see you. I met Miriam's mum many times. She was a wonderful woman who is remembered very fondly by her Baruch Hashem very large family and by many friends. And it's absolutely great that Miriam sponsored that. And also in memory of her grandfather, Natan Bat Moshe, whose yahrzeit is on Tisha B'Av itself. So people are welcome to sponsor the shiurim. We're grateful for the sponsorship, and we're happy to receive those notices, which I'm happy to announce. Now, this morning, we have to grapple with something complicated, but very important, because it's core to understanding a lot of things that go on around us that sometimes drift past us, and we don't think too much about. Last time, 2 weeks ago, we talked about early Shabbat, and the mitzvah of Tosefet Shabbat, of adding on at the beginning of Shabbat a little bit of time, and at the end of Shabbat, which is from definite Friday and definite Saturday night, to add on that to Shabbat. Today I want to look at the opposite question, which is late Shabbat. And what I mean by late Shabbat, I mean the nightmare scenario of the gridlocked highway as Shabbat is coming in, and you can see the sun sinking gently into the west as you are miles and miles from home. What are the parameters and what are the options of dealing with this question? This is a very practical halachic question. I'm not a poysek, and therefore I urge you to seek advice from your local Orthodox poysekim and rabbis. But this is a subject which I'd like to deal with in terms of the broad understanding of it, because it throws up not just halachic specific issues, but meta-halachic issues, meaning why is the halacha what it is? How was it decided? How did we get to where we are? And in so doing, it raises not only halachic and hashgafic questions, but issues of history, of cosmology, of astronomy, of all sorts of things that we're going to hopefully enjoy. Let's start with a little piece from Arut Sheva, not something we get to quote very much. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you'll relate to it. This is from a few months ago, like a year or so ago. Last Thursday, it says at the end of December 2016, LL passengers arrived at JFK Airport in New York, prepared to board LL Flight 008 to Israel. The flight was scheduled to take off 8:45 and land in Israel at 2:20 on a Friday afternoon. That's a winter afternoon, just 2 hours before the start of Shabbat. However, at the check-in, the passengers were told the flight would take off half an hour late. I'm sure you all identify with the feelings that those passengers were probably having then. Don't worry, though. We'll still arrive in Israel at 2:20, just like we're scheduled to, LL staff told them. Then after the passengers had boarded and buckled, the flight crew discovered a technical issue. They weren't able to close the plane's door. An hour later, technicians arrived and fixed the door, but then the pilot discovered he couldn't move forward and had to wait for someone to tow the plane to the runway. At 10:10 p.m., after a delay of an hour and a half, we understood that we would arrive just prior to sunset on Friday and would not make it home before the end of Shabbat, before the start of Shabbat, said D, a passenger. We decided we'd prefer to get off the plane and spend Shabbat in New York, and we requested to get off the plane, but our staff started convincing us that we would arrive on time. You don't have to worry, the pilot said. That's always very worrying when the pilot says you don't have to worry. Okay? The pilot will arrive in Israel only an hour late at 3:15. At some point, the pilot told us that if the plane went back to the gate to allow the religious passengers to get off, it would need to stay in New York for the entire weekend, leaving all 400 passengers stranded. And therefore, the pilot said, I request the religious passengers to take others into consideration, a bit of emotional blackmail going on there, and remain on the plane. He said it in those words, we had no choice, the plane took off. Basically, bottom line, the plane arrived at 4:35, exactly at sunset. El Al said, there's nothing we can do from the time the plane taxis, we can only turn back in an emergency. And then El Al made the following comments at the end. Three lines from the bottom. It should be noted the rabbis, as well as El Al staff, have mentioned several times the need to schedule winter flights earlier. so that in case of unexpected difficulties, the flight will still arrive with enough time for passengers to arrive home comfortably, concluded. And El Ala basically reflecting, as we'll see soon, the second mission of Brura, which is, if you want to get on a plane that you know will arrive ideally 2 hours before Shabbat, you're asking for trouble. And therefore, El Al made the point, which I think is quite rightly made, that if trouble happens, and it's not exactly unusual for planes, especially El Al planes, every landing always late, etc. Although truth is that El Al is much better than it used to be, it's not exactly unusual for planes to arrive late. So let's have a look at what should these passengers have done, what could they have done, and how does that work? Now, we all know, because of our experience in the world, that night doesn't just follow in a click from day. The day could just have turned off in a second and then night began, but rather there is a gradual dimming of light, which we call twilight, until eventually it gets dark. And it's very hard to actually put your finger on the point at which you can say, then it was light and now it's exactly dark. There is a gray area in between. And in fact, in terms of twilight, in secular terms, there are a number of definitions. I give you a little chart on the bottom of the page. There's civil twilight, there's nautical twilight, and there's astronomical twilight. And they're measured by the angle of depression of the sun below the horizon. And therefore, when the sun is 6 minutes below the horizon, which in our terms right now is sunset right now is about 7:50, civil twilight ends at around 8:15. Nautical twilight, which is 12 degrees below, ends at around 8:50. And astronomical twilight, when it's really, really dark, ends at about 9:27. So there's a period of at least an hour and a half, which is more or less what we call twilight. And indeed, that may start even earlier than the sunset. Let's see what the sources are and how we can deal with this halakhically. Let's start at the beginning. Number two. In the creation, Vayikra Elokim Lo'or Yom Ulechoshech Kara Laila. Day, Yom, equals Or, light. And Choshech, dark, equals Laila. So on that basis, it sounds like, what is the day in Halakha? When it's light. Okay? So far, so good. When is it light? Well, when the sun's out, presumably it's light, although we'll see not so straightforward, but it's also light after the sun sets. A few psukim later in Bereishis Aleph, we see, number three, day and night being defined specifically by the sun. V'yat Elokim et shnei ha'morot ha'gedolim. God made the two great luminaries, et mo'or ha'gedol ha'memshelet ha'yom, the greatest one, the sun, which is in charge of the day, v'et ha'mo'or ha'katan ha'memshelet ha'layla, and the moon, which is in the night, although, of course, we know that the moon is not only out at night. The moon is out often during the day, and that's a whole separate story. So they are there to light up the world. So here in the second source, it sounds like day, yom, is referred to not by the light, but by the sun. And that's a different thing. And here we see built into these two psukim some of the tension. Are we going to measure day halachically by when it's light, which sounds from the beginning of Bereishis Aleph, or are we going to measure day by when the sun's out, which is not exactly the same thing? Nehemiah complicates things a little bit. Nehemiah is describing the work on rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, which was not easy, and there were lots of people in the world at large, some of them Jewish, some of them not, who were opposed to Shivat Zion, to the Jews coming back to Eretz Israel after the Babylonian exile, and they did everything they could to try and stop the Jews from rebuilding Yerushalayim, plus Hashanj. Look at number four. Ve'anachnu osim b'malacha. We did our work, says Nehemiah. V'chetzia machzikim b'ramachim. And half of us had to be holding spears to guard because there were people trying to attack the work. When did they work? Mi'alot ha'shachar ad seita kochavim. What's alot ha'shachar? First light, daybreak, when you see the light appear on the horizon before the sun rises, at seita kochavim, until the stars come out. And you'll see Nehemiah says, Gam be'etahi amarti la'am, I said to the people, Ish v'na'aro yalinu b'toch Yerushalayim, everyone has to stay in Yerushalayim, v'hayolano halayla mishmar, and at night time we'll guard, v'hayom melacha, and the day will be a work day. And when was the day? When did they do their work? What do we just say? Mi'alot ha'shachar, ha'seita kochavim. So it sounds like from Nehemiah the day is from first light until until the stars come out. The Gemara, which is more than 12 hours in many cases, the Gemara, and we'll see a lot more Gemara soon, but the Gemara begins to define this in terms of stars, and you know how this works. But it's not going to help us that much because we're going to have to define what these stars are. Look at number 5, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. We'll see Shmuel comes up a lot here. Kochav Echad Yom. When one star comes out, that's still day. Shnayim Bein Hashmashot. Two stars is twilight. Shlosha Laila. And then there's a brayta that says the same thing. Tanina Mihachi, Kochav Echad Yom, Shnayim Bein Hashmashot, Shlosha Laila. Amar Rabbi Yosi, Lo Kochavim Gedolim. Not the big stars, which probably are planets like Venus, etc., which appears soon after sunset. Hanir imbiyom. You can even see them sometimes during the day. But lo kochavim haktanim, not the little stars. She'ein nirim ela balayla. They only come out when it's very, very dark. Ela beinonim. If three medium-sized stars come out, that's what we're talking about. So one medium-sized star is day, two medium-sized is benashmoshes, three medium-sized stars is night. And that's where you all know the idea that when three stars come out, that's when it's night. Not big stars, not small stars, but medium stars. Now, what do you do? If it's cloudy, you can forget about the stars. You ain't going to see no stars, which rules out most of Europe most of the time, and Israel in the winter even as well. Also, there's loads of light pollution now. There's no way, even in the middle of the night, there are many places in the Western world, you can't see anything in the sky apart from sort of orange. So that's not going to help us either. We're going to need some more guidance. But stars there are, and we'll have to see how they fit in. Now, I'm going to present to you four basic understandings of when night begins and day ends and night begins and how Ben Hashmashot works. The first one is little known, and it's the Ibn Ezra. I must confess, until I researched the Shir, I was unaware of this position. The Ibn Ezra, which is not a halachic source, it's his introduction to Breishit, he says an interesting thing, number 6. He talks about what they call geometric sunset. V'tam. The reason the definition of Bein Hashmashot is Rega Hayot Nekudat Agulat Hashemesh, the minute, the second when the middle of the sun, okay, the ball of the sun is Keneged Shetach Haaretz, is exactly on the horizon. Keneged Yosheh. As Chetzi Agulat Hashemesh Lamala, V'Chetzi Chetzi Acher Lamata Keneged Haadam. So the Ibn Ezra wants to say, take the ball of the sun as it's setting over the horizon, assuming you have a nice clear horizon over the sea or whatever. When the middle of the sun hits the horizon, that's what he says makes most sense is sunset, is Laila. Before then is day, and after then is night, even when half the sun is still up. And he says it's a split second. We'll see where that's coming from. Now, we do not follow the Ibn Ezra in halakha. We'll see in a minute. But it's important that you remember what he said, because that will have an impact on the discussion in 10 minutes or so when we talk about Rabbeinu Tam, who is going to figure quite strongly in the Shir. We'll see, because he was a friend of the Ibn Ezra, or at least a colleague, and we'll see how that works. But the Ibn Ezra has that position. The nature of Bein Hashmashot is very interesting, because it's like an intrinsic suffix. It's the ultimate gray area, the ultimate twilight zone. And in Hashgafic terms, it's often treated as a mashal for the imponderable, unanswerable questions. Remember when we talked about the issue of learning secular subjects, we saw there was quite a famous Gemara there in Menachos where Rabbi Yishmael is asked by his nephew, when, he says, uncle, when can I learn secular subjects? Given that I've learned all of the Torah, I now want to learn secular subjects. But it says, Vehigitib or Yom Balaila, you have to learn Torah day and night. So if you remember, Rabbi Yishmael turned around to him and said, find a time that is neither day nor night, and that's when you have to learn your secular subject. So what is he saying to him? So he's saying that there's a gray area here, and he's using Bein Hashmashot as the ultimate gray. I'm not saying yes, and I'm not saying no, I'm saying something in between, he said to him. So in that sense, we're not learning about learning secular subjects, but Bein Hashmashot is something that's always going to frustrate us a little bit. But most frustrating is the Talmudic conundrum, because the Talmud seems to say two different things in two different places. Look at number 7. San Rabbana. This is a Gemara in Shabbos. Bein Hashmashot, Safik min hayom u'min halayla. Bein Hashmashot, maybe day, and it may be night. Safik kula min hayom, all of Bein Hashmashot may be day. Safik kula min halayla, all of Bein Hashmashot may be night. Ve'ezo Bein Hashmashot. So what is Bein Hashmashot? Listen carefully, and imagine in your mind. You've all seen lots of beautiful sunsets. Now is the time to imagine. Does someone mind just closing the door at the back, if that's okay? Mishetishcha achama, from shkiyat achama, when the sun sinks. Now, when does the sun sink? What does that mean, Shkiyat HaChama? It could mean sunset, but it doesn't necessarily mean sunset, because the sun is going down for quite some time before sunset, and quite some time after. So let's not assume that Shkiyat HaChama necessarily means the sun going below the horizon. That's when it does go below the horizon.
It goes down quickly.
Quickly, but they have to take some time still. Kol zman shepnei mizrach ma'adimim. As long as they're still red on the eastern horizon, not the western horizon. The western horizon stays red for quite some time, but says this source on the east, when they're still red on the east where the sun is opposite, that's still bein hashmashot. And then he gives another definition. Hichzit tachtom. When the dark part of the, when the lower part of the eastern sky goes dark, v'lo hichzif ha'elyon, but the upper part is still bright. Bein hashmashot. That's bein hashmashot. However, hichzif elyon, when the upper part goes dark as well, the hishvel tachtonim is equally dark to the lower part, zehu laila. That's nighttime. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. What does this mean? So, as you know, as the earth, as the sun goes below the, of course, the earth's turning. Let's assume that the sun's going around the earth for a second. More about that in a minute. But as the sun goes below the earth casts a shadow on the sky. And as the sun sinks lower below the horizon, we're obviously not seeing it by then, it's below the horizon. As it goes lower, the shadow that the earth is casting on the sky is getting higher and higher into the sky. So at the beginning, just after sunset, the lower part of the eastern horizon is darker, but the upper part is still picking up sunlight. It's still illuminated. Says the Gemara here, once the upper part becomes dark as well, so that's called Laila. But while there's a difference, that's Bein Hashmashot. And he gave two definitions, red on the west in the eastern sky, and this light-dark differential. We'll see in a minute they're basically the same thing. But then Rabbi Yossi Omer, the end of number 7, Bein Hashmashot Keheref Ayin. He says, no, he much more follows the position we saw the Ibn Ezra follow. It's a split second. Ze nichnas, v'ze yotze, day goes out, night comes in, v'i efshal la'amod alav. And you'll never know when it is. Split second. It's not a period. It's an actual second. It's an instant. The Gemara in Shabbos in number 8, which I'm not going to read inside, basically asks, why do we have two definitions of Bein Hashmashot according to Rabbi Yehuda? Why do we have a red on the eastern sky and also a light and dark? He says they're the same thing. That when those two things are happening at the same time, then that is Bein Hashmashot. Go over to page 3, please. In terms of Hilchot Shabbat, and don't forget that's what we're trying to define here. The Gemara says on the same, in the same sugya, Amar Rabba Bar Bakhanan, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Halacha to Rabbi Yehuda, we pass in like Rabbi Yehuda, that there's a long Bein Hashmashot, it's not an instant, Le'inyan Shabbos, when it comes to Shabbos, L'chumra. Because don't forget, when it comes to Shabbos, we want to be Machmer, because there is an Issa De'oraita, which is a Chi of Koreis, to do Malacha on Shabbos, to do work on Shabbos. So we're going to try and avoid anyone's opinion as to what might possibly be Shabbat, i.e. once it's Laila. If there's any possibility that it's Shabbat, then we'll say, okay, that may be Shabbat. So he says, the Gemara here, we're going to take Rabbi Yehuda's view, which says there's a long Bein Hashmashot, just to be on the same side. Now, in terms of time length, which we didn't see so far, we've been talking about red and light and dark, the Gemara now puts a time on it. Look at number 10. Shi'ur Bein Hashmashot Bekama. So how long is this period of Bein Hashmashot? Amar Rabba, Rabba says, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, in the name of Shmuel, Shlosha chelke mil. Three parts of a mil. Defined in a minute, we'll see. My shlosha chelke mil, and what does that mean? And the Gemara goes through different analyses. What could we mean by three parts of a mil? So the Gemara concludes in the end, talta rivai mila. Three quarters of a mil. Fine. Whatever a mil is, we'll see in a minute, three quarters of a mil is Bein Hashmashot. So even if I can't see the horizon, as long as I can work out how long that time frame is, then I'll know when Bein Hashmashot is and when night begins. The only problem is, well, not the only problem, but one of the main problems is, the Gemara in number 11, in the same Tana, in the same opinion, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mishkiya Tachama at Teta Kochavim, from when the sun goes down to when the stars come out, Arba Milin, is 4 mil. Now, that's a problem, because we were just beginning to get some sense of clarity. Three quarters of a mil, we'll see what that is in a minute in time frame. But now all of a sudden the Gemara in Pesachim says 4 mil. And there really is the heart of the problem. Because the Gemara seems to say in two different places, two very, very different definitions of how long Bein Hashmashot is. meaning I'm not clear about red and light and dark. It really depends on the weather conditions, on where you're standing, etc. But at least I can measure how long it takes to walk. But now you've told me two different things, and I don't know which to take. Is it three quarters, or is it four? By the way, some, the Maharam al-Shaka, which we'll mention later on, who was a colleague of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Sikaro, says, look, it's very straightforward. Rav Yehuda just changed his mind. He started off saying 4 mil, which is the Gemara in Pesachim, and then he said, no, actually I've changed my mind, it's 3/4 of a mil, and therefore he just dismisses the whole 4 mil thing as being irrelevant. We'll see, most people aren't so quick to do that, but that is one way to resolve it. So what is a mil? The word mil, of course, is the same word as the English word
mile.
Okay? However, a mil is not a mile, because even a mile is not a mile. Because the word mile itself comes from the Latin mile passus, which is 1,000 paces. And in fact, the Romans had something called a Roman mile, which was, I brought you in footnote 3 for those who are interested in these kind of things, a Roman mile was around 1.4 kilometers, 1,400 meters. A modern English mile is 8 furlongs, if that helps you, if you're into horse racing. But 8 furlongs is 1.6 kilometers, so that's a bit more than a Roman mile. But it doesn't end there because, and I have no clue about this until I researched it, but there was such a thing as a Scots mile, which was even bigger, 1.8 kilometers. A nautical mile is a little bit bigger than that. The Irish mile was just over 2 kilometers. The Welsh mile, which apparently was very common until the 13th century, was just over 6 kilometers. Okay, the Prussian mile used until relatively recently was nearly 8 kilometers, the Austrian mile similarly, the Hungarian mile was over 8 kilometers, and the winner is the Norwegian mile. The Norwegian mile is 11.3 kilometers. And therefore you see the use of the word mile is a fairly useless expression. Because a mile means many different things to many different people. For us, the mil, the halachic mil, is actually the smallest of all of these. It is 2,000 amot. Now, so how big is an amah? So an amah is, as you know, the distance from this finger here, which is actually called in halakha the amah, because it measures the amah, to the point of your elbow. So how long is that? Well, everybody's different, right? So just like the English foot is not dependent on your feet, so too the amah is a standardized measure, and it depends on who you ask. Rav Chaim Noah says it's around 48 centimeters. The Chazon Ish famously said a bit more, around 57 centimeters. So what is a mil? Around about a kilometer. It's anywhere between 960 meters and 1,152 meters. So good. So now I know what is a mil. So how long does it take to walk a mil? And a couple of you said to me before the shiur, depends on whether you're 20 years old, 70 years old, 90 years old. It really depends. So for an average healthy person to walk a mil, how long does that take? So have a look at number 12. The Shulchan Aruch says, shiur mil. Have a revit sha'a is a quarter of an hour, v'chelek me'esrim min hasha'a, plus a 20th of an hour. And if you add 0.25, which is a quarter, and 0.05, which is a 20th, you get 0.3, which is 3/10 of an hour. Says the Mishnah Berurah very helpfully, number 13, v'hu yudches minuten. That is 18 minutes. Now you know where 18 minutes comes from. The 18-minute mil. Bit of a slow run, but it's a reasonable walk. However, life is again not so straightforward because the Vilna Gaon, and I'm not getting into all the reasons for this, the Vilna Gaon understands that the mil is actually a little bit longer, it's 22 and a half minutes, and actually the Rambam in number 15, the shiur, what is the shiur of a mil? Look at number 15, kidei shehalech adam baraglav, that a person can walk on their legs, halach benoni, at a reasonable pace, mil echad, one halachic mil, which is 2,000 amot. V'hu kidei shnei chomshei sha'a. It's 2/5 of an hour, min hasha'ot hashavot. And here he makes it very clear, we're not following seasonal hours. Meaning people don't walk faster in the winter than they do in the summer, okay? Usually. And therefore he says these hours are straight hours of 60 minutes. And the Rambam brings it out to be 24 minutes for a mil. So just to summarize, and I brought you a little summary at the bottom, the halachic mil, Shulchan Aruch said 18, the Gros said 22 and a half, the Rambam said 24. Plug that into Bein HaShemashot. Remember what we said. If you say Bein HaShemashot is 3/4 of a mil, so how long does that last? Says the Shulchan Aruch 13 and a half minutes, the Gros will say nearly 17, and the Rambam will say around 18. If Bein HaShemashot is 4 mil, so the Shulchan Aruch will say 72 minutes. You probably heard that number before, 72 minutes. Now you see where it comes from. It's 4 times 18. The Gro would say 90 minutes, and the Rambam would say 96 minutes. Now that's already quite a long time, 96 minutes. If you're going to tell me that Bein HaShmashot is 96 minutes long potentially, then that's really very long, and that doesn't match any kind of reality that we see. As was said over here, the sun sets and it gets dark in Israel really very quickly. Certainly far, far, far less than 96 minutes. Now, maybe it depends on where you are in the world. If you go to Iceland, then maybe the sun sets much more slowly, and we'll deal with that question in a few minutes. Yes?
Why do they do this in miles and not in time?
Oh. Because it's a very interesting question. They measured everything by way of a walk of a certain mil. Why didn't they measure things in time? Because they didn't have the equipment to measure time. That's why. Modern day clocks only became reliable in around the 15th, 16th century. They were invented in around the 11th, 12th century. Sundials can tell you hours if you're living in a sunny place, and of course they're useless at night. Okay? Water clocks were only in the homes of the extremely rich, and exotic people. Sand clocks, they couldn't measure 18 minutes. There was no way to do that. And we'll see soon that Rabbeinu Tam, that's the question on Rabbeinu Tam, where we'll get to him in a minute, from the 11th century. But when it comes to walking, everyone can measure walking. So the time it takes to walk this is an easier measurement to have. And the inability to measure time is chronology is actually an issue here. By the way, what you see, just in parentheses, is it's very hard to measure fractions without the use of decimal places, etc. We can do very complex calculations now very quickly. You know, a seventh grade math student can do them on a piece of paper. Things that took lines and lines and lines of working out complex fractions in the time of the Gemara. The digit zero only came into general use long, long after the Gemara was written in the Middle Ages, in around the 12th, 13th century. That's why sometimes when you open up the Gemara and they're trying to work out how to calculate the volume of the mikveh, and it takes them 15 lines to work out how to calculate the volume of the mikveh, something today we could do in a half a second just by a very quick calculation. That, just be thankful for decimal placement. If you want something to be thankful for in the mornings when you wake up in the morning, be thankful for decimal placement. It's made life a lot easier. Now, how do we resolve these Gemaras? We have a Gemara that says a 3/4 mil and a Gemara that says 4 mil. So there are basically three approaches. And I'm not going to look at all the sources inside, but I want to focus on Rabbeinu Tam because he's the star of the show. The Vilna Gaon says, I'll tell you how this works. Bein HaShmashot starts at sunset. Look at number 16 for a second. The Mishnah Berurah is bringing the opinion of the Gra. Says the Gra says, V'herich v'kama rayot, he brings many proofs. Shkia tachama sheva Shabbos. When it comes to Shabbos, when is Shkia? When is the beginning of Bein HaShmashot? Le'ini Bein HaShmashot. Who gamkem hatchalat Hashkia? It's the very early part of Shkia. Kamo Shkia tachama sheva Pesachim. Okay. Umiyad achashkia guf hashemesh matchil Bein HaShmashot. As soon as the sun has disappeared, and it's not the middle of the sun lahalocha. It's once that I'm sure you've all stood on the beach watching a sunset, and you stay there till the bitter end, till that last little bit of the sun just twinkles and disappears below the horizon. That, says the Vilna Gaon, is the beginning of Bein HaShmashot. Okay? Adlibud Rabbi Yehuda, the Pasuk Rabbi Yochanan Kvaseh, Lechumra B'Shabbat, Umeshach Zman, how long does that last for? Gimel Rav Rivai Mil. 3/4 mil. Says the Vilna Gaon, therefore, Bein HaShmashot starts immediately the sun goes down and lasts for 3/4 mil, which in his understanding is around 13 and a half minutes. Let's call it 18 minutes, because we saw there was a debate about that. But it starts at sunset, and it ends around 18 minutes later. The Uraim, who was Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, who was a very important poetic in the Balei HaTosfos, the Uraim says, no, actually, I think that Bein HaShmashot starts even before the sun goes down. Because the sinking of the sun doesn't just begin at sunset. The light begins to fade and change quite significantly before sunset. And he actually measures this 3/4 mil before sunset. So he says that Bein HaShmashot begins already when the sun is still up, around, let's say, 18 minutes before sunset, and nighttime begins when the sun goes down. So his whole Bein HaShmashot is shifted earlier a little bit, and it ends at sunset rather than begins at sunset. And then we have Rabbeinu Tam, we need to spend a bit of time on, because Rabbeinu Tam comes up with a very different answer. See number 18. By the way, the Rambam and the Rif, it's not clear exactly how they rule on this, but they seem to go with the opinion of the Vilna Gaon and the Gaonim. It wasn't just the Vilna Gaon, the Gaonim, which was the mainstream opinion in the Babylonian academies, went with this view that the Vilna Gaon later champions, which is sunset to around 18 minutes later. But Rabbeinu Tam says no. And we'll see why. Number 18. Rabbeinu Tam raises the question, and he raises the contradiction between 3/4 of a mil in Shabbos and 4 mil in Pesachim. And just look at the underlined little bit at the end of 18. The Yesh Lama, here's his resolution. The Hachka Amar. Here it's talking about, it's in Pesachim, Mitchilat Shkia. There are 2 shkias, he says. You didn't realize this, but there are actually 2 shkias. Beginning, the first shkia, Hainu Mishash Mitchilat Hachama Likanet Ba'Ogah Harekia, that's when the sun begins to disappear into the thickness of the atmosphere, of the firmament. Ad Halayla, all the way until night begins, Hu Dalet Milim, that's 4 mil. The Hasam Ka'ama Mitzav Shkia. But then there's another shkia that begins just before that and lasts 3/4 of a mil. Let me tell you what he's saying. Fascinating, we'll see where he gets it from. Says Rabbeinu Tam, I'll tell you how to reconcile these 2 opinions. Shkia is not just 1 thing, it's 2 things. The beginning of shkia is when the sun sets. And that's still daytime. Halachically, that's still daytime. The very end of the process is 4 mil later, which could be 72 minutes. Let's say it takes 72 minutes. He says, but the first 3 1/4 mil of that is still day. And Bein HaShmoshes halachically only begins in the last 3/4. That's how he put these 2 things, he puts these 2 things together. Again, yeah, and I brought you a chart at the bottom so you can see it clearly, and also I've summarized it. Rabbeinu Tam says from the very beginning to the very end of the process is 72 minutes. The last 18 minutes, or 13 and a half potentially minutes of that, depending on who you take, is Bein HaShmoshes. But all of that period at the beginning is just what he calls the first shkia, which is not halachically Bein HaShmoshes. What is the upshot of that for us? According to Rabbeinu Tam, even after the sun sets, and not just a few minutes, but up to 58 and a half minutes after the sun sets, it's still yom. It's definitely day. Shkia only really begins the halachic Bein HaShmoshes, if you like, in the very last part of that, and lasts, if you like, from 58 and a half minutes to 72 minutes. Now, if you followed Rabbeinu Tam through to its logical conclusion, then all of our times for the beginning and the end of Shabbat would be very much later. Because Shabbat would not begin when the sun sets. Why would you begin when the sun sets? It's still definite day, halachically, for another 58 minutes after that. Only 50-something minutes later would you have to light candles and then add Tosefet Shabbat, etc., etc. And of course, Shabbat would go out also much, much later. The question is, where does he get that from? And do we follow it? Go over the page, please, to page number 5. The Mishnah Brura in the Bir Halacha actually says that even within Rabbeinu Tam, there are 2 ways of viewing it. Is he talking about 6 hours of 60 minutes? And it doesn't matter where you are in the world. And that's the first opinion he brings. Look in 19, the Prima Gadim says, Hadalet Milim, these 4 mil, these 72 minutes, Heim Sha'af Shavot. They are equal hours, Veloz Maniot, and not seasonal hours. Im Kein Lefiza Afilu B'Tkufat Hamuz. Therefore, even in the middle of midsummer, Gam Kein Hashiuza, it's still the same fixed 72 minutes. But then he brings another opinion and says, no, absolutely not. Rabbeinu Tam's 72 minutes was only in the equinox, okay, in April and September, and only, because he's explaining the Gemara, only on the level of Bavel. But if you go further north, when everything takes longer, or further south, when things are quicker, towards the equator, and if you go to midsummer or midwinter, everything will change. And therefore, you can't just take Rabbeinu Tam as 72 minutes. You have to take it as whatever the equivalent would be at the time of year and in the latitude that you are, and adjust accordingly. Correct. Well, they knew that the things differ as they go further north. Now, where did Rabbeinu Tam live? Rabbeinu Tam lived in Ramerut in France, okay, which is much higher than the latitude of Babel, okay. It's much further north. But the Vilna Gaon lived in Lithuania, which is even higher still. So the question is, all of these people are living in different places. Are they looking at what's happening around them in order to make these measurements? Meaning, if you go to where Rabbeinu Tam lived, and then sit there in the summer and look at the sky and the sun setting, you will not get to his time frame. And even more of a question, how did he measure it? The lady at the back asks, how do they measure time? Rabbeinu Tam could not have measured 72 minutes. There was no way for him to do that in those times. And even more of a question is, Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, the Uraim, who we said has a very different position, he says that sunset is just before, the skier is just before sunset. He was the main student of Rabbeinu Tam. What happened when the Uraim went to his Rebbe for Shabbos? When were they lighting Shabbos candles? Was Rabbi Eliezer of Metz lighting Shabbos candles way before sunset? Because as far as he's concerned, Fein HaShemasha starts 18 minutes before the sunset. And was Rabbeinu Tam merrily sitting there, doing his work and plowing his fields and whatever, getting ready, singing his songs for Shabbos, and lighting his candles an hour later? And how did that work? The Ibn Ezra, we saw before, has a certain position. He stayed with Rabbeinu Tam. The Ibn Ezra had a very interesting life and a very difficult life. And at one point, he actually lived with Rabbeinu Tam. What did he say when Rabbeinu Tam was lighting an hour later than he felt that you should light? We saw last week he is particularly critical of what he sees as people starting Shabbat too late on Shabbat morning, and the Rashbam, we saw that before. Yet last time, what did he say to Rabbeinu Tam? Now, where's Rabbeinu Tam getting this from? So let me now throw in a very interesting discussion. Number 20. How does the sun go round the earth? Well, you'll say to me, it doesn't go round the earth at all, because we live in a Copernican universe where the earth is clearly going around the sun. But let's go back to Ptolemy and the Ptolemaic understanding that the sun goes around the earth. Number 20. Chachme Yisrael Omrim, says the Gemara in Pesachim, which this Rabbeinu Tam is based on. The Gemara says, the Jewish rabbi said, the sages said, Bayom chamama halechet lemasa min arikia. The sun, during the day, goes underneath the firmament. We see that. It rises in the east, sets in the west. Where does the sun go at night? Ubalaila lamala min arikia. And at nighttime, says the Jewish sages, it goes through the firmament, disappears behind it, so you can't see it, and then it goes back up over the top, okay, from west to east, and then the next morning it emerges back through the firmament. That's called the twilight, the dawn, okay, and then it appears, and then it goes underneath again. The Chachmei Umat HaOlam and the rabbi and the sages of the non-Jewish world, Omrim, they say, by day the sun goes under the firmament. Ubalaila, where does the sun go at night? Lamatam in a karka, it goes around the other side of the world. Now, that's more according to what we understand as to what happens at nighttime. So who won this debate? Did the rabbis win or did the non-Jewish sages win? I'm a Rebbe, so Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi said, V'nirin divreihem midivreinu. I think on balance, they're right and we're wrong. He says, we follow the non-Jewish sages on this particular issue, which we learned once before is a very interesting question as to, you know, what do we do when we feel Chazal are making statements about science which do not accord with the way that we see science today? And this is a famous source brought by Rav Hirsch to say that if the science of the day does not fit with what Chazal seems to say, then we go with the science of the day. That's a whole big topic, which is not for now, and it's not necessarily halakhically applicable in all situations. But here we see a debate, and the rabbis versus the non-Jewish sages. And the non-Jewish sages won. Let me let you into a secret. Look in number 21. Says Rabbeinu Tam, I'm a Rabbeinu Tam, the Afar gav the nitzchu chachmei umat ha'olam. Even though the non-Jewish sages really won, the chachmei Yisrael over the Jewish sages, haynu nitzachon b'ta'anot. That means they won in terms of their arguments. Aval ha'emet hu kechachme Yisrael. But the real truth is like the Jewish sages. Okay? Don't we say that in the morning in tefillah? The sun breaks through the window of the firmament. So now you see, the Rabbeinu Tam came up with his idea of the two shkias, the beginning and the end, and this is clear in the Ran, I'm not going to go through it in 22, because he's working off a cosmology that assumes that the sun goes back through the atmosphere, that's twilight, and that takes a long time, and over the top where you can't see it, and back through again in the morning. And the Vilna Gaon turns around later and says, well, that's very nice, but that's just not right. That's just not accurate. That's not the way the sun works. And Rabbeinu Tam says, okay, well, that's what the Gemara says, but I think really the Jewish sages are correct. So we now have a problem, which is Rabbeinu Tam's position seems to be based off of a scientific model, which is not correct. More of a problem is Rabbeinu Tam's position is followed by many, many of the Rishonim, including the Rosh, the Ramban, the Rashba, Rabbeinu Yochanan, the Ran, the Smag, the Magid Mishnah. And most challenging for us is in fact the position that the Shulchan Aruch brings. Look over the page on page 6. Because this is when it begins to get interesting. I mean, maybe it's already been interesting, I don't know. But this is when I think it begins to get even more interesting. Rabbeinu Tam has now gone against the position of the Gaonim that lived before him, who said that Bein HaShemoshes begins at sunset. And he says, no, Bein HaShemoshes begins nearly an hour later. And we see that halachically, many of the Rishonim, the classic authorities of the medieval period, follow Rabbeinu Tam. Did they actually do that? Which is what I raised before. And I brought you a reference in the footnotes in number 15 to a very interesting article. It's about 100 pages long by Professor Shlomo Sternberg of Harvard, which was put in the BDD. BDD is the Bar-Ilan Journal. B'chol Derecheihu Dehu. B'chol Derecheihu Dehu. They published this in the journal about 20 years ago, and he has a very extensive article. He suggests there that even though Rabbeinu Tam said this, and even though many of the authorities in the Rishonim agreed with him, he says he doesn't think anyone actually did it then. And he brings various different proofs as to how he believes in the medieval period, actually they kept much more the Gaonim. I mean, you have to read his article. But no, there's no question that by later periods, the 17th, 18th century, we'll see people did keep Rabbeinu Tam l'maisa. Look at number 23. Number 23 is the Shulchan Aruch, and he basically says, Safik Hashecha Vahu Ben Hashmashot. Safik, when it gets dark, is what we call Ben Hashmashot, and he says it's 3/4 mil. And then in Bet, he says, so what is Tosefet Shabbat on Friday night? When do you add on? Yesh Omin Shitarik L'Hosif Michol Ele Kodesh. So you have to add on, we saw this last week, from Chol to Kodesh. Uzman Tosefet Zeh. What is this period, which is definitely Friday, remember, definitely day, that you should add on a bit to Shabbat. Hu mitchilat hashkia. This begins at sunset. She'ein ha-shemesh nired al ha'aretz, when the sun is no longer visible. Ad zman bein ha-shmashot. All the way till bein ha-shmashot. That's the period, he said, which is still definitely day, which you can add on to Sefet Shabbat. This period of adding on is 3/4 mil. This is, without any question, the position of Rabbeinu Tam. Which is not surprising, because it's the majority position of the Rishonim, although it's not, maybe not the Rambam, but he passes like Rabbeinu Tam, and the Ramah agrees. What does this mean? This means that the Shulchan Aruch, which usually is pretty much our go-to place for halacha, says that Shabbat actually doesn't begin till around an hour after sunset. Okay? Now, maybe Professor Sternberg's right, maybe he's wrong, maybe they were doing this before, maybe they weren't doing it before, but one thing is for sure, through the 17th, 18th, 19th, and early 20th century in Europe, they were following Rabbeinu Tam. The Chasam Sofer in number 24 brings very clearly, he says, Am Minag, Hine Anachnu Kulanu Bebin Yisraelu, all of us in these countries, Oisim B'Malacha Erev Shabbos Kodesh, Ad Korav L'Shao Gimel Revi Yishar Kodem Tezak Kachavim, we do Malacha later on Erev Shabbos, Nimsa Anu Toisim B'Muchlat Keshitat Rabbeinu Tam. We definitely follow Rabbeinu Tam, and if you were to look at the literature from Europe, from around 1650 through to 1940, you'll see that most European communities, they brought in Shabbos late, and they took out Shabbos late. Again, not just Rabbeinu Tam at the end, but Rabbeinu Tam at the beginning. And they would be driving around until half an hour, 40 minutes, 50 minutes after the sun set on Friday. And have you ever seen anyone doing this in a religious community? Yeah. Where? So we'll see B'Shat Adchak in a minute. The Mishnah Brewer comes in and says, okay, I accept that this is what has been happening across the board. You'll see this in Rav Dov Tzvi Hoffman, in Pressburg, in Hungary, across the board. But you can't do that anymore, says the Mishnah Brewer. We absolutely have to be choshesh for the position of the Gaon, of the Gaonim, and of the Vilna Gaon. He says, even though the Shulchan Aruch passes like Rabbeinu Tam, both the Mechaba and the Ramah, and even though that is the position of many, if not most, of the Rishonim, can't do that anymore. We have to go back to the original position of the Gaonim, and he writes in number 26, just in the underline, he says, V'chas v'shalom. It says, God forbid, he says, lahakel bazeh, that we should ever be makel in this, to whose sophic is the skila. This is a question on an issue of skila, of a death penalty mitzvah of Shabbat. God forbid we should be makel. Even though the general position in Europe for the last 300 years before him was indeed to be lenient. In fact, there is even evidence that people were lenient on the way in and lenient on the way out. There is evidence, and this is greatly criticized by the rabbis at the time, that people relying on Rabbeinu Tam when Shabbos came in, but taking out Shabbos a little bit earlier when Shabbos went out. And there's a lot of discussion as to why that changed. Professor Sternberg suggests a few things changed. He says, number one, it became much easier to actually calculate time because they had proper clocks by the 18th century, 19th century, and therefore you could work out 72 minutes. Much easier than before. He also suggests that the printing press made a massive difference, because the Shulchan Aruch was written by Rav Yosef Karo in Tzfat, and the only printing press in Israel at the time was in Tzfat in the 16th century. So the Shulchan Aruch, really within 30-40 years of being printed, being written, was on the desk of every senior posek in Europe, which had never really happened before. So in this position and many others, the Shulchan Aruch became very much the accepted position, even though there were others that had criticized that before. The Bach actually says, I'll tell you what happened. The Bach says that there were merchants at the great fairs in Lublin and Jaroslav, and they needed to work late on Friday afternoon. And therefore they started pushing and pushing and pushing more. He doesn't like this, okay? He actually wants to follow the Urim, which is even earlier, and he says because of people pushing at the envelope there, that's how it happened. But there's no question that it happened. There are almost no communities today that follow Rabbeinu Tam Lekula on the way into Shabbos. There are reports of the Hasidic community in Lakewood, which I'm not familiar with, and I don't want to say that's what they do. If there is a Hasidic community in Lakewood, I'm sure there is, because I was told that, doing this. That I was told that the Hasidim in Sao Paulo in Brazil are still lenient. Again, I can't prove this. I haven't done a field trip. Maybe one of you can tell me if you've been to daven with the Hasidim in Sao Paulo, that they are still maker on the way in. But you won't find this anywhere else. Even the Hasidim living in Eretz Israel and living in London, they'll daven mincha late Lefi Rabbeinu Tam, meaning you can walk into a Mincha Minyan at 10:15 p.m. in London and hear Ashrei Yoshevei Veisecha. That you will hear, okay? But yeah, 10 o'clock at night. But you will not see people driving around Golders Green or even Stamford Hill an hour and a half, half an hour after the sun goes down. The question I want to raise now, in the last 15 minutes of the shiur, is what's going to be B'Shas HaDchak? How are you going to do this? Now, at the end of Shabbos, the Mishnah Berurah says it's very recommended to keep Rabbeinu Tam at the end of Shabbos. Which you can understand, because, again, let's flip it on its head. Rabbeinu Tam was the main position of most of Europe and the Shulchan Aruch, certainly up to the Second World War. And therefore, it's something of a palate, something of a surprise, that we don't keep Rabbeinu Tam on the way out. That's a show of hands. Who here is from a background where people keep Rabbeinu Tam at the end of Shabbat? Well, that was resounding, wasn't it? Okay? Okay? Now, there are many people living not far from here that keep Rabbeinu Tam at the end of Shabbat, and we'll see soon that it's a very big surprise that we don't. We treat this as a little bit of an extreme chumrah. We'll see soon it's not an extreme chumrah at all, and it's a bit of a surprise that we don't keep it at the end. Now, just before we get into the Shas HaDchak position, let me just mention that the Elal staff were absolutely right. There is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch that you should not be traveling on Friday unless you know you can get where you need to go in very good time for Shabbat. And that's brought down in number 30 in the Shulchan Aruch, who says, certainly if there's no one there preparing Shabbat for you, you have to get wherever you're getting to in good enough time to make Shabbat. He says, unless you're left in a situation of danger. Right. And he says, you should not generally be traveling more than 3 parsa'ot. 3 parsas is 12 mil, which would be 12 times 18 minutes, which whatever that is in hours, 3 hours or so. He says you shouldn't be traveling more than that on Shabbat. The Mishnah Berurah says, let's look at number 31 here. This is an important source. I know I'm skipping a little bit, but I want to make sure we get to where we need to get to. The Mishnah Berurah says, Ubevinidas Eila Roi Bnei Adam Machnechin in Tzarche Shabbos Berevach. Most people today don't have to make Shabbos from scratch. As soon as they get to where they get to, they come into a community, people are making Shabbos. Ulachain ein is harim bezer. Therefore, technically speaking, we're not bound by these, you can only travel 3 parsa'ot, 12 mil, on Friday. Bein kushaho lech lebeite, whether you're going home, or lehit hareach, bebeit acherim, or you're going as a guest. We're not technically bound by that. Ubaharbe achronim ra'isi. But many achronim write, shekasev mikol makam tzarech li yizaher, you need to be careful lechatchila on Friday. Shelo yelech o yisa Ad samach le'erev. Don't leave it too late, says the Mishnah Berurah. Mipnei shekam ha'pa'amim nichshalim al yidei zeh, because people make bad mistakes. Ubaim yidei chilul Shabbat. When they break Shabbat, because they're all panicky when people come late. Kibalu shviza, because your hosts, he says, or afiru bebeis, or even your family, kishivasumach l'shabbos, moisifin levashel, they'll throw extra food into the cholent, because now all of a sudden they have four more guests for Shabbos. Bishvilo, machalalin Shabbat, and they'll be machalal Shabbos. V'gam kamapamim yere, the lo yegil malon, and sometimes you get stuck on the highway, he says. Well, basically, you don't get to the inn, or you don't get to your house. In good time, until it's dark. People carry and do all sorts of things. We'll see the tchum in a minute. Please, he says, bear in mind on a Friday, even if you're going to a village, what can go wrong? You're just going a few miles. Please give yourself time. Don't let your Yetzahara fool you. The lineman say, there is still enough time. It's a good journey. I catch the later flight. Don't worry. I get. It's not good, especially when the weather can sometimes make things even harder. Now, so it went wrong. Now, you, for whatever reason, you did your best. You set off in time, and now you're sitting on the highway. You're on I-95 or the North Circular, whatever speaks to you. And the sun's going down, and Shabbos, and you know you're not going to make it. So, first of all, you have to realize that there are some very clear heterim joining Benesh Mashot. Look at number 32. Anything which is rabbinically prohibited, says the Shulchan Aruch, lo gazru aleihim Benesh Mashot. There is no prohibition during Benesh Mashot. As long as it's for a mitzvah, which getting home for Shabbat certainly will be, or dochek, or it's oppressed, etc. V'chein im haya tarud v'nechpaz adava shehu mishum shvut, and if there's any drabonim which is driving you crazy, you haven't been able to do it, it's important to do, muta ben ashmashot. You're allowed to do that ben ashmashot. U'mitamze muta loma ben ashmashot la'akum, you're allowed to ask a non-Jew la'hadli klinol ne Shabbat, to light Shabbat candles. Let's say you left it too late, and you ran in the house, and it's now sunset past, because we're not keeping Rabbeinu Tam, let's assume. You're allowed to ask a non-Jew to light the candles for Shabbos. I know it feels a bit strange, your non-Jewish labor lighting Shabbos candles. I'm not sure she's going to do all this business before she lights, but you can ask him or her to light Shabbos candles for you. The Mishnah Berurah makes one qualification, he says, that only if you didn't yet accept Shabbat. If you were Makabel Shabbos, then it's Shabbos for everything, apart from one thing we'll see in a minute. Or if your community accepts a Shabbos. We saw last week that even if you say, I don't want to accept Shabbos, if the community, if you're in one community and they accept Shabbos, so that's you as well. You get dragged in after that. But if you didn't accept Shabbat, let's assume you're on the highway and you're not in the community yet and you're saying, I'm not accepting Shabbat, during Bein HaShmashot, you certainly have the ability to do a rabbinic prohibition. Now, what would that be? That could involve carrying muksa, that could involve asking a non-Jew to get things or to do things, but it won't help you driving your car. Because driving your car, there are many Torah prohibitions involved, but in terms of drabonon, that's pretty much accepted. You certainly can rely on Rabbeinu Tam for Bein HaShmashot. For example, I brought you in the footnotes there that Rav Yosef Rimon quotes Rav Moshe Feinstein, that if you're stuck during Bein HaShmashot, and you have to do rabbinic prohibitions, then yes, there it's not very controversial. You can rely on Rabbeinu Tam, even a later Bein HaShmashot, which again will go until around 60, 70 minutes after the sunset, okay, and ask non-Jewish people, etc., to do things. But that's not going to help us when it comes to driving the car. Let's look at some issues on the late traveler. Oh, good, that'll be fine. Let's look at that right now, and let's finish the shiur with some ideas. The late traveler, here we are, some guidance. Again, I'm not posek. Please don't rely on things that I say lamaisa, but hopefully it'll be helpful. Number one, leave enough time on Friday, that's clear. Number two, once you're clear, you won't make it back to Shabbos, you have to try and make alternative plans, meaning if there's a closer community, or if there's a hotel you can check into, even though it's very bedieved, you don't want to be sitting in a motel all through Shabbos, miles from your family. If you can, then you should. You can't just break Shabbos because you'd rather get home. If you're in danger, very clear, that's uncontroversial, of course you can continue to drive. If you're in a snowstorm and getting out of your car and walking through a blizzard, that's not safe. Or if you're on the highway, you can't just walk down the middle of the central reservation on the M25 to get home. That you can't do. During Ben Ashmoshes, I said before, you can ask a non-Jew to do anything. That's clear, even if you have been Makabel Shabbos. And during Ben Ashmoshes, you could perform a rabbinic prohibition. That's why you need to know your Hilcha Shabbos. You have to know what's Doraisa, what's the Rabbanon. I'm very particular when I teach my students Hilcha Shabbos. They need to know what is the Torah prohibition and what is rabbinic for situations like this. There's also an issue of tchum, and that's the problem. You cannot go beyond the tchum on Shabbat. The tchum is 2,000 amas beyond the extremities of the town. Now, if you're in a big town, that's not a problem. So let's say you have a non-Jewish taxi driver. You run out of the airport, okay? And it's almost Shabbos. You for sure, maybe it's even after sunset, you could ask a non-Jewish driver to take you home, okay? That's not a problem. It's asking a non-Jew to do something during Ben Ashmashot. But the question is, where is home? Now, if you're in Heathrow Airport, fine, you're within the Tum. You're not going beyond the Tum. But if you're in a little nowheresville and the airport is way outside town, you have problems, because if you do travel outside the Tum on Shabbat, then you're very limited in what you can do once you get to your destination. So Chazal say you can only walk in 4 amas in any direction if you left the Tum on Shabbat. Now, that might not be so terrible, because you could walk inside the building. That's why people stay in the airport. Let's say your plane lands on Shabbat. It's dark, it's black, the stars are out. So you can't leave the airport. Why? Because you come from outside the Tchum, you're stuck inside the airport. Or if there's an Erev inside the Erev, there's a famous story of Lord Jacobovitz. Lord Jacobovitz, this is brought down in his biography by Chaim Bamant, I brought you a little story at the bottom. Lord Jacobovitz, when he was the chief rabbi of Ireland, used to travel a lot from Ireland to the mainland of England. And once on Thursday night, when he boarded his ferry on Thursday night, the fog rolled in from the Atlantic, and the ferry was delayed, and he ended up getting into Dublin Harbour way after Shabbat. He'd radioed ahead to Lady Jacobovitz, not yet then Lady Jacobovitz, Mrs. Jacobovitz, and told her this might happen. And she'd travelled with her little baby to the dock to meet him with a bit of wine and a bit of challah, and he arrived on Shabbos. They asked her Shaila. He told her to ask the Dayan there, Dayan Aloni, and he told them he can't get off the boat. So she arranged for a non-Jew to take the kid, because she couldn't carry him home, it's Shabbos already, and the food onto the boat. Rav Jacobovitz then went back to England on Shabbos, on the boat, with his kid and the food, and back to Ireland on Shabbos afternoon, Saturday night, and eventually got to Ireland somewhat poorer in money, because they charged him a fare back and forth, okay, and eventually got off the ferry on Sunday, because he would keep on beyond the Tum, and he couldn't get off the boat. Just go over the page and let's finish off in the last couple of minutes. So there are other options with trains, etc., and I brought down some ideas here. The question is, can you rely on Rabbeinu Tam? And this is where I haven't got time. Just give me 2 minutes. So you tell him that, first of all, if it's Ben Ashmashot, maybe you can handle the muksa, because it's a rabbinic prohibition. But second of all, you can show him your wallet and tell him to take the money from your wallet, and then you'll be fine, right? You just have to get the right driver. Let me just finish with this question, because this is very interesting. Someone comes along and says, okay, fine. I can find a safe place to stop. I can stop in a motel. I can stop in a hospital and sit in the waiting room all through Shabbos. I could do that. But if I rely on Rabbeinu Tam and keep driving home, I can get home to Shabbos. Can I rely on Rabbeinu Tam even to do Torah prohibition during his Ben Ashmoshes, but to get me to a more ideal situation? Meaning I could stop, but I don't want to, because I'll be stuck in a hospital for the whole Shabbos. So I asked this over the last week to many, many people. Is there any heter these days to rely on Rabbeinu Tam at the beginning of Shabbos in a really pressed situation? Almost everybody said no. One rabbi said yes, okay, if you really have to, but almost everyone said no. The question is why? Rabbeinu Tam's position was the Shulchan Aruch, most communities in Poland, okay, and Germany and Europe, not just Poland. Why is it now in 2018 not possible to rely on Rabbeinu Tam when this was the position that your great-great-grandparents took? They wouldn't have even understood the question, because they would have said, of course we keep Rabbeinu Tam. You keep it on the way in, you keep it on the way out. So that Shabbos, you'll keep Rabbeinu Tam at the end. And the answer seems to be this. It's a great, it's very astounding that we don't keep Rabbeinu Tam, like I said before, at the end of Shabbos. That we bring out Shabbos earlier than everybody else used to do, at least in the last 300-400 years. And now that we have, as a community, have decided very clearly that the end of Shabbos is according to the Vilna Gaon, Rabbeinu Tam's kind of been just written off the books now. We no longer have the minhagim that we had. The Shoah, the Holocaust, was a break with the minhagim of Eastern Europe. And the clear minhag of Am Yisrael now, almost across the board, is not like Rabbeinu Tam. It shows you the power of the community in overriding what were very clear halachic positions and clear minhagim, although, of course, the other position we take is also a halachic position. But even though that was the mainstream position, now clearly it's, most people say you cannot rely on it. You'd have to stay in the hospital or the hotel for Shabbat. And there's another interesting answer as well, which gets into Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's rupture and reconstruction that I've mentioned before, which is that after the war, we don't really have any masoras anymore. We have books, and we look up halacha in books. We don't really do what our great-grandparents did in the mainstream, most, for the most part. And the Mishnah Berurah, who has become a pretty much a go-to place for many people to decide halacha, he's very, very against following Rabbeinu Tam, into following the Vilna Gaon, and that has become very much the way that people rule. Now, you can ask your rabbi, see what he says. I know one rabbi, as I said to you, that you said you can rely on Rabbeinu Tam. I'm not going to tell you who it is publicly. But most people will say that you can't, and it's a very interesting shift in halacha in that way. Okay, next week, bit of a trailer. I hope to talk about something completely different, which is I want to talk about the way that we relate to, halakhically and hashgraphically, probably the most important text that humanity's ever received, which is the Ten Commandments, which we're going to be reading in Shabbos next Shabbos, not this Shabbos, but next Shabbos. I want to talk about that and how its role in the Jewish service has changed significantly over the last 3,000 years. We'll have a look at that. It'll be very interesting. Please God. Until then, have a great week.
Can you give me a minute or not?
Yeah, I can. Let me stop this.